Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host for this program. Our producer is Patricia Colbert. And behind us, supporting us, is the KBOO staff who've done a remarkable job of keeping the station going through difficult times. We of the Old Mole appreciate them. This morning's program is a true variety hour with environmental, public health, labor, and international themes, accounts of people in struggle, inspiring actions, and the dilemmas and choices faced in working toward a better world. We'll go from the Portland Harbor Community Coalition to cross-border worker organizing and the U.S. government's attempt to suppress it, from a new organization created to challenge the corporate-dominated and politicized Center for Disease Control, to the history of nearby smelter workers and the militant union they built. As is often true for the Old Mole, our contributors bring personal knowledge and their own direct involvement in the issues they discuss. I mentioned our appreciation for the folks employed at KBOO. I like to imagine them decently housed and fed. We're in the spring membership drive now, with something special. A group of donors has banded together to match, dollar for dollar, any contribution you make up to $12,000. However much you're able to donate, it will be worth double the amount. Individual donations do make up 80% of KBOO's budget. Please go to kboo.fm and use the Give button. And now, Bill Resnick talks with Cassie Cohn, director of the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. What city policies led to the Willamette being so polluted? And how are the communities that live near the harbor mobilizing to restore its health? Bill?
Hi, Cassie Cohn. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Bill.
Cassie Cohn is the director of the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. Actually, she's also now the lead organizer and phone answerer, though they are hiring a second staff member very soon. The coalition is a great example of why local struggles for climate justice are today probably the fastest growing and most dynamic parts of the U.S. environmental movement. Right here in our River City, actually it's a river metropolis, the Portland Harbor Community Coalition demonstrates how a very low overhead volunteer-powered organization can become a thorn in the side of the city's economic and political elites. They do that by battling for the health and well-being of the low-income communities that live and breathe along the harbor and eat the fish and the rest of it. Cassie, tell us why and how the coalition organized, and what are your major projects today?
Thank you. So we found out about the Superfund site, and by Superfund, I mean the Portland Harbor, this 10.8-mile stretch of the Willamette River from the Broadway Bridge or the Fremont Bridge all the way up to the south end of Sylvie Island has been designated since 2000 by the federal government as one of the most contaminated sites in the nation and is a priority cleanup site. So we, as in another previous environmental justice organization called Groundwork Portland, were informed about some big decisions that were coming about the Portland Harbor Superfund site back in 2012. And we were called to action. Basically, community leaders felt that there was a void, that there were not existing groups focused on especially organizing and making aware and mobilizing communities that have been disproportionately impacted, either historically or on an ongoing basis or currently, by the contamination in the Portland Harbor. And so at the time, we did a number of dialogues and discussions with existing conservation groups. We checked in with the six tribes that have treaty rights to the Willamette River, who already had a very formal role in the Portland Harbor Superfund project. And basically, all parties at the time were supportive and felt like there was a gap and a need for a group to focus on mobilizing the community around this issue. And so we got started, and it really was just a very grassroots effort centering groups that have membership and that serve and represent those different communities. So like the Native American community or tribes, the Black community, many of whom came from the South to work in the Kaiser shipyards, had jobs working on the river and were often exposed in the 40s and 50s and maybe didn't even realize some toxins that they were exposed to on the job that were also contaminating the river and the fish at the time. You know, also a lot of those families lived close enough that they had a very intimate relationship with the river and the culture of fishing and consuming fish. And that's for the most part been cut off for a lot of these intergenerational families. Immigrants and refugees, over the years, there's, you know, the Latino population, the Eastern European, the Slavic community, the API community are big fisher communities, and it's subsistence fishing that they depend on. And so unless word gets around in those communities that the Portland Harbor resident fish are not safe for mothers and their babies, for example, those folks will continue to consume fish. So we found it pretty critical. It was sort of high priority for us to just at least even get the word out that this was an issue so people can choose for themselves about what to do about it. And so for the most part, and in an ongoing basis, we, as new people are made aware, there's usually initial shock because people don't understand why didn't I know about this before? And so we have to unpack that. And then sometimes there's a whole added trauma response if people can think about how their family members or they themselves potentially have been impacted or exposed over many years or many generations, and that, you know, authorities did not warn them or their families in the past, and that there's nothing that can be done necessarily. So we feel like our coalition needs to actually focus on that healing, and it's not easy, you know, because agencies are not willing to go there necessarily, right?
Yeah. One of the things that environmentalists have going for them in this country is laws passed in the 60s and 70s, the environmental laws. They had broad provisions for intervening and regulating companies and their toxic discharges. It's a very broad authority to step in, but often they don't, right? That's the problem you face. Your problem is getting the state to do the things that they should be doing. How do you deal with that?
I guess what we have learned is that even though, I guess, the determination of, you know, the cleanup level for Portland Harbor and other Superfund sites is based on an environmental and health risk assessment and years of research, in the end, communities always end up feeling that the Environmental Protection Agency is not really addressing the cleanup in the way that they want. That to, you know, the regulatory agency, to the federal government, cleanup means do it to avoid risk at kind of the basic level and to basically save money as much as possible. That's the influence of the responsible parties, right? So they want to protect their bottom lines. So they will do everything to attempt to slow down, to minimize the cleanup level, to undo the record of decision, which is the legally binding decision that EPA has for Portland Harbor.
Yeah. Your organizations, the whole set of organizations that are working with or are part of the coalition, are trying to force the EPA and the state and the companies, too. You can embarrass them and force them to agree to do things. You depend on, I think, volunteers, actually, in some ways, to not just the officials of the organization who testify and stuff, but also in building, you know, mass support in the galleries, for example, in the city council, when 300 people show up there and are a little bit semi-rowdy, or at least vociferous. That makes a difference, and it also makes a difference the size of the organization and the knowledge people have. Tell us about how you do the recruiting and the way that you develop this sort of knowledge and, you know, feelings that people have that they can make a difference.
Well, the way that we organize is to build power and in an intersectional way. So from the beginning, we have always had folks from different communities with sort of multiple identities and their own sort of unique connections to the river and understandings about what their priorities are around, you know, cleanup of the river. And what we ended up finding was that there were a lot of commonalities and that we were able to easily, over many years of dialogue, reach a consensus around what the highest priorities and sort of standards were. You know, for example, like people want to be part of the solution. They want to have a role in cleaning up the river because they feel a part, they feel connected to the river. Well, even folks who have processed how they've been disconnected from the river and why, through our coalition, start to get reconnected and realize that they can have a sense of ownership and, you know, have a voice around pressuring the cleanup to happen in the right way, for it to be done in an equitable way, for it to provide career pathways to folks who need work. For example, you know, there's, as we know, we're in a housing crisis and an economic crisis ongoing during the pandemic. And there's, you know, people experiencing houselessness get pushed out to the river all the time. So people rest near the river, they get exposed down near the river. You know, what if folks could be actually part of the solution and be provided jobs training and job opportunities to participate in habitat restoration, you know, some of those other cleanup jobs. And then, you know, future redevelopment in and around the river is going to be, you know, once the river is cleaned up, economic development is going to become a big deal. And so how to do that in the most equitable way, and to think ahead about how to get more access to the river for people to recreate, more salmon habitat, for example, as well, and green space integrated into development that happens along the waterfront, you know, how to work in housing options for all income levels. Those are some of the things that have come up as priorities in our coalition, and, you know, different mechanisms and tools to realize those visions. For example, securing a community benefit agreement for the cleanup of the Portland Harbor. So that's one of our major campaigns currently and ongoing.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Cassie Cohn, the director of the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. We've talked about the struggles to clean up the Willamette River as it flows into the Columbia. We've talked about the ways the various movements have used environmental laws to embarrass the city and the state and the companies, but not yet, in fact, have a cleanup of the water. There's a great struggle over how complete and about the extent of the cleanup and what's needed. Cassie, thanks a lot for talking to us. So one final thing. Of course, the harbor cleanup and the cleanup of our air and waters, that's essential for our communities, especially cities. But of course, it's terrible in rural areas, too. Problems are somewhat different. Climate scientists see that we have very few years left. It seems to me we all have to be part of the struggle to transform our economy towards renewable energy and also transform every one of our productive processes and the way we live and keep our buildings warm in the winter and cooler in the summer. Nearly every aspect of life, especially in the developed, quote, developed countries, has to be changed. Do you see that the rest of the environmental movement, which you're a major part of, How do you relate to that problem and the solution?
Currently, PHCC is planning with other partners like the Affiliated Tribes of Northwest Indians and others to do a community and tribal resilience plan for the river in this area of the river in Portland Harbor. So, you know, we are working on securing resources to make that happen, but it will be from the ground up. You know, it'll have research components and vulnerability assessment, but also have basically community input, tribal input around the impacts and how climate changes affect, you know, the cleanup of the river and should, you know, really influence the methods around cleaning up the river. And then, of course, the proximity of the Superfund site to the critical energy infrastructure hub in Northwest Portland, right, that, you know, where all of the gas and oil tanks are providing the majority of the gas and fuel for our entire state. That's a huge, obviously, that's a huge liability if for the climate, for the river, for the people that work and live and recreate around there. So we have to work on those intersectional issues more and more.
Cassie Cohn, so good talking to you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Bill.
So long.
That was Bill Resnick with Cassie Cohn. Here's Patricia Kohlberg with a word from KBOO.
During its more than 50 years on the air, KBOO has taught thousands of volunteers how to do radio, all for free, giving voice to the multiplicity of communities that make up our city. KBOO is a critical community resource. We are looking to raise $56,000 during our spring drive. Please help out if you can by donating today. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
And now, here's our same Patricia Kohlberg with this morning's Well-Read Read.
Life expectancy in the U.S. declined in 2020 due to the COVID pandemic, which claimed close to 400,000 lives that year. This drop in life expectancy was seen across the globe. However, in most other countries of the global north, life expectancy recovered in 2021, but not in this country. COVID is now the third highest cause of death in the U.S. after heart disease and cancer. The reasons behind these grim statistics are complicated and involve innumerable factors and players. Today, I want to focus on the role played by the Centers for Disease Control, or the CDC. I'm a former public health official, and during my 20-some year tenure at Multnomah County Health Department, the CDC had a sort of godlike status among me and my professional colleagues. We considered the agency a reliable, science-based, and ethical institution, a global leader in promoting public health, and whose work and support we drew on constantly. I was quite dismayed then when I read in February 2020 that the CDC had rejected the domestic use of COVID testing kits from the World Health Organization through some sort of weird scientific hubris. And furthermore, the CDC's own first test included a faulty reagent and was basically worthless in the field. During those early weeks of the pandemic, you couldn't get a COVID test to save your life, literally, and it was the CDC's fault. Then came the CDC's delay in recognition that the virus could spread through tiny airborne droplets. This delay was driven by a failure to deploy experience, good judgment, and courage in the face of a crisis. There was not enough evidence, they claimed. There was, of course, a downside to the recognition of airborne transmission. People would need to wear masks. That recommendation came out far too late from the CDC, not only because of their scientific timidity, but the fear that recommending masks, which were in very short supply, would deprive healthcare workers of the necessary life-saving gear. To that, I might ask, Where was the CDC when stockpiles of personal protective gear fell to dangerously low levels in the U.S. already prior to the pandemic due to profit-driven, just-in-time supply chains for essential goods? The bungling and missteps and mixed messaging continued and were driven to new levels by the overt politicizing of the agency by the Trump administration. But even the newly supportive and scientifically oriented Biden administration has not put an end to the problems. Now a group of fed-up health professionals has stepped into the ring. It's the newly formed People's CDC. They announced their arrival on the scene through a manifesto published April 3rd in The Guardian. What I'm going to read is an edited version of their statement titled, "The CDC is beholden to corporations and lost our trust. We need to start our own." Here's what they wrote. A new Omicron variant, referred to as BA2, is taking hold in the U.S. Anthony Fauci and others have said they don't expect a new surge. But BA2 is causing devastating surges elsewhere, and the policies and behaviors we might use to prevent a surge have been widely abandoned, in part thanks to the CDC's new system for measuring and conveying COVID risk. In late February, the CDC unveiled a new COVID-19 monitoring system based on what they call community levels. The new system instantly turned what was a pandemic map still red from Omicron transmission to green, creating the false impression that the pandemic is over. The new CDC narrative let President Biden claim victory over the virus via sleight of hand. The previous guidelines called anything over 50 cases per 100,000 people substantial or high. Now, they say 200 cases is low, so long as hospitalizations are also low. The resulting shift from a red map to a green one reflected no real reduction in transmission risk. These new guidelines are at odds with evidence-based and equitable public health practice in three fundamental ways. First, they do not intend to prevent disease spread. By minimizing the importance of new cases and focusing instead on hospitalizations, the revamped warning system delays action until surges are well underway and the consequences are already in motion. Making matters worse, at-home tests are not recorded in the U.S., causing a significant undercount in the true number of cases. Secondly, the new guidelines shift the burden of responsibility onto vulnerable people. In place of guidance on masking for those facing greater risk, for example, the CDC simply advises individuals to consult with their local health care provider. This assumes that providers are accessible, well-informed, and willing to take on the personal liability for giving guidance around a potentially fatal virus. In a country without health care for all, these assumptions are wrong. Thirdly, the guidelines are blatantly political. The new recommendations aim to convince the public that this pandemic is over when it is not. They suggest we tolerate the nearly 1 million U.S. dead and too quickly abandon measures that would keep that number from growing. They suggest we continue to isolate those with chronic illness while the rest return to normal life. They suggest long COVID isn't the rapidly growing crisis that it is. They dismiss the near inevitable emergence of new variants. They dismiss the urgency to vaccinate the rest of the world. The shift from red to green reflects both major U.S. parties turning the page on the virus as a political problem, rather than a change in the reality of the pandemic. And the red to green shift also paved the way for the political class to wash their hands of would-be fights over COVID funding. Some claim that the White House and the CDC are following the science and doing the best they can. But if the goal is to prevent infection and suffering, the updated recommendations do not align with science or equity. It's more accurate to say they're following the money. They've put the desires of corporate America above the needs of our people, and especially our most vulnerable. We need a CDC that prioritizes the health of the people, not the health of big business. We need a people's CDC. And so we formed one. We're epidemiologists and physicians, artists and biologists. We're children, parents, and grandparents. We've come together with a common anger at our government's disregard for social and public health responsibilities. We greet this work with humility, recognizing there are still many uncertainties, yet we know enough to reject, with certainty, ineffectual public health policies based on individualistic approaches. And we are certain that there is another way, that collective action has always and can now create a new way forward in responding to COVID and other deadly pathogens. We've already put out a statement and recommendations about BA2, a statement regarding the CDC's new recommendations, and we brought together a coalition of groups to create an equity-focused toolkit to help parents and teachers demand the best COVID protections in schools. We are in the midst of developing COVID weather reports on the state of the pandemic based on epidemiological data rather than what corporate America demands. We demand a layered, collective, and equitable approach to the pandemic. We recognize that none are safe from contagious disease until we are all safe. It is with this understanding that we will continue to share the latest on the state of the pandemic, toolkits for action, and recommendations on what to do, developed for and together with community organizations. For it is only through collective power that we can create a new, more equitable world that can not only control outbreaks, but also prevent them from emerging in the first place. You just heard an edited version of a statement by the People's CDC. You can visit their website at peoplescdc.org, and we'll post links to their website and other social media outlets on the Mole's webpage at kboo.fm, where you'll be able to find their latest weather report. I'm Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour and for the People's CDC.
Thank you, Patricia. Coming up, we engage with a couple of new books. For one of them, we talk with the author. The other is a review. Years ago, Matt Witt was part of a project to link Ford Motor Company workers in Mexico with their counterparts in the U.S. That effort is now the subject of a new book, El Golpe, by Rob McKenzie. Matt draws on his own experience in reviewing the book. The voices you'll hear other than Matt's are from a documentary he made, $4 a Day, No Way, Joining Hands Across the Border. The documentary is available on YouTube. Here are some of those Mexican workers, then Matt. Hardly a day goes by without a reference by some politician or corporate CEO describing working people in the U.S. and other countries like Mexico or China as competitors in a global labor market. U.S. workers have to accept lower living standards, they say, in order to compete with our counterparts elsewhere. But what if that's a smokescreen? What if what's really going on is that global corporations are driving down pay, benefits, and worker rights for working people in every country in order to drive up profits and CEO pay for themselves? I thought about this again recently when reading a new book called El Golpe by Rob McKenzie. El Golpe is a Spanish term that can be translated as the hit. And in this case, it's about a hit job carried out by a big corporation and its political allies against working people in both Mexico and the U.S. The story is a real-life mystery full of greed and corruption, but also courage and inspiration. It's a true story, not about conspiracy theories, but actual documented wrongdoing by people in high places. It's a story about the past, but also shines a light on developments that are in the news now. And it happens to be a story about events that I personally was involved in, though I never knew everything that was going on behind the scenes until now. In 1990, I was working as an independent journalist in Mexico when I learned that several hundred hired guns had entered a Ford auto plant outside Mexico City and opened fire on the workers, murdering one and wounding many others. The gun thugs had been provided Ford uniforms and ID badges, and workers later obtained leaked payroll records showing that the gunman had been temporarily put on the company payroll and then removed after the attack. It was the culmination of a dispute that had been going on for years at that plant. The workers had taken over their union, which had been long controlled by a corrupt labor federation called the CTM, that functioned as an arm of Mexico's ruling party. With new democratically elected leaders, the workers had been demanding better pay and working conditions. Ford, the CTM, and the Mexican government combined on a scheme to get rid of the workers leading the democratic union. And when workers protested, the squadron of gun thugs appeared at the plant to forcibly remove the leading troublemakers. Over the next year and a half, I covered the story as the Mexican workers courageously fought for their rights through sit-ins, work slowdowns, and marches. To get media coverage, they even conducted a nude-in in which they removed their clothes in the offices of a government labor relations agency to show that they stood naked before the law. As I began working on a 20-minute documentary film about their struggle, U.S. workers from several Ford plants in the Midwest heard what happened at the Mexican plant and offered their support to their counterparts. Through their local unions, they raised money, they asked tough questions at company promotional events, and they talked to their co-workers about the need to help raise average pay in Mexico, which was then as low as $4 a day, so companies like Ford couldn't play off one country's workers against another's. In the film I made, called $4 a Day, No Way, Ted LaValle, one of the union workers from Minnesota, explained it this way.
We don't want to see Ford closing their factories in Mexico, but what we want to see Ford is to pay a high enough wage so the products that are being built by the workers, that those same workers can afford those products. That way, the competitive edge that Ford now uses as pitting the U.S. workers to the Mexican workers would not be there.
On the first anniversary of the murder, workers at Ford plants in Mexico, Canada, and the Midwest all wore black ribbons to show their solidarity with the ongoing struggle. As Ted LaValle reported,
there was almost 100% participation, which not only showed support, but it gave our workers an understanding of the struggle that was going on down in Mexico.
Ron Pellerin, a leader in the Canadian auto workers, put Ford's attack on workers in all three countries in a broader context, as so-called free trade agreements were being pushed by corporate interests and their political allies.
And I believe that's a part of the right-wing agenda, and we all know what that means. If you have, you get. If you don't have, too bad.
After months of protests, union workers from the Midwest came to the Mexican plant when the Mexican government was trying to hold a rigged election on whether workers wanted to be in the CTM or join a different union. I stood outside the plant with these U.S. workers as the Mexican workers were arriving by bus at shift change. Hundreds of police in riot gear formed an intimidating cordon around the arriving workers, who were going to have to vote out loud in front of their supervisors. To show solidarity, the workers from the Midwest shoved leaflets through bus windows that said, in Spanish, "We support your democratic right to choose your own leaders." Barbara DeGroat, one of the Minnesota workers, told me that day,
"With the wages they pay them, they can't possibly maintain a family. That's all we ask. If everyone could come down here and just see the banners and listen to these people, they would try and understand that the Mexican worker is not taking their jobs. It's Ford Motor Company."
Author Rob McKenzie also worked at the Minnesota Ford plant at that time. Years later, after he retired, he decided to dig deeper into what happened at the Mexican Ford plant. He sifted through official archives, sometimes finding that the file he wanted just happened to have gone missing after he asked to see it. But with the help of a U.S. senator, he used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain actual copies of cables sent by the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City to the State Department in Washington, D.C. Those cables make fascinating reading as they show our government clearly supporting the interests of big corporations and not working people. The U.S. ambassador and his aides wrote that they were worried that the workers' struggle for better pay and working conditions might discourage U.S. companies from moving operations to Mexico. But, they reported happily, quote, the government of Mexico has kept news coverage of the Ford dispute well under wraps, end quote. At one point, the local union at the Ford plant in Minnesota invited two workers from the Mexican plant to conduct a speaking tour in the Midwest, visiting workers at shift changes, speaking at conferences, and conducting interviews with U.S. media outlets. I arranged to accompany them, both to report on their tour and to help with translation. What I didn't know until I read McKenzie's new book is that the U.S. Embassy was sending cables to the State Department at the time that urged action to stop the speaking tour and to stop U.S. unionists from supporting their counterparts in Mexico and interfering with measures used by the government of Mexico to suppress the dissidents. The tour took place as planned, but reading these cables certainly showed me which side our government was on. Today, the history in the book El Golpe and in the documentary film $4 a Day, No Way, continues to be relevant as workers in Mexico are still organizing for the right to choose democratic unions that will fight for a better life. In early February of this year, workers at a GM plant in Mexico who make as little as $2 an hour voted by 78% to leave the CTM and join an independent union instead. A few weeks later, workers at a Mexican plant owned by Tridenex, a U.S. auto parts company, also chose a democratic union. In both cases, workers in Mexico and their union supporters in the U.S. had protested corporate interference with workers' free choice. And in both cases, companies faced the threat of tariffs from the Biden administration if they didn't back off. It will take a lot more international solidarity like that to improve living standards for working people on both sides of the border as allies and not as competitors. Rob McKenzie's new book is called El Golpe, E-L-G-O-L-P-E. And the 20-minute documentary, $4 a Day, No Way, is available free on YouTube.
Again, you can find Matt's documentary, $4 a Day, No Way, Joining Hands Across the Border, on YouTube. And you can donate to KBOO on the website or by mailing a check to the station during the spring membership drive. Your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Ron Verjou is the author of the just-released book, Smelter Wars, focusing on a community and workplace just across the Canadian border. There are lessons for us in them thar wars. I talk with Ron as part of our regular segment, Another World is Possible. One of the key issues in talking about the possibility of a society organized differently from what we have now is the potential role of unions. Are they agents of social change? Can they be? What kind of leadership that's interested in fundamental social transformation, what can it accomplish in unions? And what kinds of unions can be agents of social change. What form would those unions take? Ron Verjou has written a book based in history where he explicitly begins by asking, well, by saying that what he's looking for are new insights, new directions for labor today. The book is Smelter Wars. It's published by University of Toronto Press, and it's set in Trail, British Columbia, just across the US border along the Columbia River. Ron is a longtime, I would say lifelong, union activist. He's worked for unions, notably Canadian Union of Public Employees. Living in Oregon, he was our chapter's vice president of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. And most notably for us, he began his working career working in the smelter that he writes about. Ron, welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland.
Thank you, Norm, and hello to all my Oregon friends and colleagues and trade union fellows and sisters and brothers.
Good. We will circulate this, actually, this recording, this interview to all of them. Let's start with smelting. I always like, we'll get to all the political questions in just a bit and the union questions, but the actual work that people do. Tell us, what is smelting and what's the work like that you experienced, actually?
Yes. Well, the area we're talking about, as you described, it was well known both on both sides of the border for the ore that they were digging out of the mountains around that area bordering the Columbia River. And it was, first of all, copper, silver, gold. It was the precious metals, but it ended up being more lesser ore like lead and zinc. And those ores were being shipped in the back in the day by a sternwheeler boat and train into Trail, where there was a big smelter, which was built in 1895 and opened in 1896. And those ores went into furnaces and were blast furnaces, and they were melted down and refined into ingots of ore. And that was an innovative thing in the day. And it required a lot of just laborers, muckers in some cases, that just shoveled the ore. Heavy ore, by the way, I can tell you, I can attest to that. And that was something that mostly required day laborers. It started to develop into some specialties too, people who knew about assaying ore and knew about processing the different kinds of metals, separating them. Some of the things that, and even in my day, were interesting were just the big lead furnaces and lead refineries and zinc refineries, where these massive kind of factories had men kind of looking like they were maybe from some other planet, because you had all the as much gear as you could get on to protect yourself from the workplace hazards, which were prominent even then and were much more prominent in the days I wrote about in Smelter Wars. There were pretty much fatalities every week. Now, the smelting process itself is interesting in Trail, because they developed much earlier on, they developed a system or I guess it's a refinement method to get zinc out of the ore. Zinc was important. The smelter was around for just about 10, 15 years before the First World War hit. And zinc became increasingly important, because that was part of the metal that went into bullet casings. That's what was formed. And of course, lead formed the other part of it. So the Trail smelter became pretty critical to the Allied efforts in the First World War. And it was because that ore was being refined and sent off to be produced, to produce bullets. Second World War, the same thing. There were huge productions involving many people. As you know from reading the book, that was the war where many, many women in the area began to work on the so-called male jobs in the smelter. So they were also involved in processing these metals for the war effort.
They're an important part of the story, and I want to come back to the way you handle both ethnic and gender issues. For our younger listeners, I want to point out that our region was the home for many smelters. And when I first came out here in the 1970s, we had smelters from Tacoma, to Troutdale, to Goldendale, across the Idaho Panhandle and into western Montana. This was smelter country.
Yes.
I think nearly every one of those has disappeared now, but the huge complex in Trail is still going, still active, and one of the largest in the world. We were smelting in this region lead, you mentioned, zinc, copper, and aluminum, bauxite also. And of course, the smelting process, just to be very clear to our listeners, is a combination of heat and can be also a chemical process, the two. And so the smelter at Trail that you describe is multiple buildings where ore is transferred from one kind of a process to another, and also produce, I was interested to learn, both fertilizer and during World War II, of course, you were producing heavy water that went into making the really big armaments, you know, the big bombs.
Yeah.
The book is organized, and I wanted to mention how well written the book is also. I mean, this is an actual plug for Smelter Wars. It's a really well-written book, and it's organized in ways that I appreciated around big questions where you repeatedly ask the questions and kind of foreshadow what's coming next. The big part of the story is the union of mine, mill, and smelter workers and how they become a union, popularly known as mine, mill, and then the attack on mine, mill. So let's begin with the process whereby the workers in Trail actually get a functioning union after company union, you should say what that is, company town, near company town, and all the labor management co-op schemes and welfare schemes and everything designed to prevent unionization. What's the process by which they end up actually with a militant union?
Well, let me just retract for a minute and just say that on for American readers, one of the major actors in Trail was the smelter builder, one of the so-called copper kings, Fritz Heinz, coming out of Butte, Montana, where they were always worrying about who could get more money out of the earth. But he came in 1895, as I mentioned earlier, and built the smelter. So that probably brought in a number of people from Butte to work there who had some sense of unionization, had some sense of the need, the requirement in a smelter for unions. The process of developing a union goes back much further than I talk about in the book. Around 1905, they formed the first Western Federation of Miners local in Trail, Local 105. And that, as you know, Norm, was a pretty active union. I mean, they were a tough union. They fought battles and tooth and nail, and sometimes with bullets and bombs. And that's another history that's not exactly part of this story. But ultimately, during the war years, they were struggling to get a decent contract. And the result in 1917 was a big strike at the smelter. The only strike for many, many years. It took place that winter for about 3 months. A guy named Ginger Goodwin, who's become a famous labor martyr, led the strike. It was lost, and the Western Federation of Miners more or less abandoned the local. In 1916, Mine Mill was created, a kind of softer version of the old Western Federation of Miners, and they lost the thing. Even their president basically abandoned them, and the company won the day. What the company did then, under a man named Selwyn Blaylock, was they created the Workmen's Cooperative Committee. And the WCC was a classic company union, and they maintained the shop by paying for the company union, giving it office space, paying for its meetings, and the various perks that entailed, and they held sway until the 40s. I think it's fair to say the union probably wouldn't have gotten started if it hadn't been for changes in legislation, both in the province of British Columbia and then eventually federally, that made it a little easier to organize unions. But what also made it interesting was that a fellow named Slim Evans drove into town in 1938 and then 39, and he basically started the union movement there, or restarted it after this long period of company unionism. And Slim was he'd been a communist since 1926. Party started here in 1921. And he was a flamboyant character. He was a kind of a, I wouldn't call him swashbuckling, but he liked to go into the local pubs and taverns and talk it up with the working people. And he was one. And he came with a real reputation, both in the States, where he was machine gunned at the Ludlow Massacre, believe it or not, and had a lifelong injury to his leg, and then led something during the Great Depression called the On to Ottawa Trek. 1935, a bunch of guys got in a train and wanted to go to Ottawa to complain about the treatment of relief workers in that period. And they did so. And Slim was the leader of that movement. So when he got to Trail in the fall of 38, he was pretty well known. And it took him and the kind of the wordsmithing he could wield and the abilities he had to get along with the workers to sort of make this union development start to take place. It took another 6 years. Slim left town. He got kind of turfed out of town. He got taken to court for, I'm not sure exactly what anymore, but they didn't like him there because the authorities didn't like him there. He got picked up for drunkenness and then he had a car accident. Eventually he just picked up and left town. He was picked up by another communist. And this slowly developed until about 1943, 44, when a big federal bill came in, something similar to the Wagner Act, which I'm sure your readers or your listeners are familiar with. And that opened up the possibility for organizing a union and defending a union. And that from there on, it kind of paved the way for a third communist leader, a guy named Harvey Murphy, to come in and actually seal the deal and sit across the table from this fellow Blaylock and make a first collective agreement. So that's sort of the trajectory of where it went from there. But as you know, that's just sort of the beginning of the book and the beginning of the Smelter Wars.
Let's pause the conversation at this point. I've been talking with Ron Verjou about his new book, Smelter Wars. At least a couple of references have come up that require some background or clarification. One, that we coincidentally commemorated this past week, is the massacre of miners and their families in 1914 at Ludlow, Colorado. Ron mentioned that Slim Evans, the communist organizer, had been wounded by machine gun fire at Ludlow. Evans was lucky to escape. Coal miners were on strike there at two Rockefeller-owned mines. National Guard and company security forces shot into the miners' tents, killing wives and children indiscriminately, as well as miners, and burning survivors alive. We remember this horrible event in the class struggle every April 20th. Ron also referred to the Wagner Act in the U.S. as enabling union organizing that might otherwise not have happened. The Wagner Act, officially known as the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, was a response to a tremendous upsurge of worker organizing during the Depression. 1934 had seen major strikes and even general strikes among Teamsters, glass workers, textile workers, and longshoremen, notably in the Midwest, across the South, and all along the West Coast, but pretty much everywhere. The Wagner Act was an effort to tame that upsurge by channeling it into unions subject to legal and administrative regulation. It did very much encourage organizing, even while it channeled the outcome, and led to union victories in auto, steel, etc. As Ron points out, Canada passed similar legislation, which in turn made the job of creating a real union, not a company-controlled one, a lot easier. So where does that leave us in the conversation? Talking about Communist Party leadership in the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union raises several interesting questions. How was that leadership different from the leadership of other unions? Did they have a different vision for what unions could be? For instance, more rank-and-file controlled? Were they more vulnerable to the anti-communism that took so much post-World War II political space in the United States? And how did that McCarthyism play out in Canada? What about a non-communist left? What dilemmas did it face in working within a communist-led union? And then there are questions that arise in looking at any unions of that era and that still have resonance today. How did they respond to the influx of women into the unionized workforce? What role did they assign to cultural activities? These are worth going into with Ron in some depth. We'll resume the conversation in the next episode of Another World is Possible. This has been Norm Diamond talking with Ron Verjoux for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Before turning the program over to Patricia for one last time, I'd like to thank today's contributors, Old Mole's Bill Resnick, Patricia Kohlberg, Matt Witt, and John Nelson, and Bill's guest, Cassie Cohn, and my guest, Ron Verjoux. The Old Mole is on every Monday morning at 9 o'clock. In honor of our conversation with Ron, our outro music will be the Canadian labor anthem, Where the Fraser River Flows. The singer is Utah Phillips. Till next week, this is Norm Diamond, hoping you stay safe and stay active. Patricia?
I'd just like to point out that only on Cable are you going to hear ideas about the world that depart from the prevailing capitalist orthodoxy and an exploration of the ways we can collectively build a just, inclusive, and sustainable world. And now is an excellent time to give because your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thanks to all of you who have given to support community radio in Portland.
Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, for shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win a day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. Fellow workers, pay attention to what I'm gonna mention, for it is the clear contention of the workers of the world that we should all be ready, true-hearted, brave, and steady, to rally round the standard when the red flag is unfurled.